chapter 11. Continuing on, looking at these series based upon the people that are recorded here and their faith. This chapter is known as Hebrews Hall of Faith, all of them being examples of the outworking of faith. In the last couple of sermons, we were giving thought to the faith of Abraham. in verses 8 to 10, it's the faith of Abraham in relation to the land. God had promised to give him a place, an inheritance, and called him to go on a journey with his family and his servants and all of his belongings and possessions. And so he went off. He was obedient to the word of the Lord, and we're told not knowing where he was going. So faith is to obey. Faith is to trust God. That's what Abraham did. And then last week we were looking at verses 11 and 12, and that's the faith of not only Abraham but Sarah as well that's recorded there. And that is in relation to the promise that from Abraham would spring a great nation. And we are told that by faith they were strengthened. Focus is Sarah, but it's really both of them when you read it, that they were strengthened through faith to have the child and for Abraham to have offspring, through whom would come offspring, eventually resulting in a great nation. The backdrop, of course, is the fact that Sarah was barren to begin with. They'd never been able to have children of their own. For all the years and decades they were married, she never felt pregnant. And God came to them with this promise. And after 11 years it hadn't eventuated, Sarah came up with the idea then of having a surrogate mother, Hagar. Perhaps Abraham could go into Hagar and maybe she would bring forth the promised child. And that's what they did. And, of course, Ishmael was born. And we just made the point that faith can become impatient. Faith can lack trust. It can be weak. It can fall when it comes to obedience, and when that's the case, people tend to take matters into their own hands. If what they want or what they envisage God to have for them, if it doesn't come to fruition, then they'll make it happen themselves, and of course there are disastrous results. So that is exactly the case with Hagar and Ishmael. 25 years after the promise was given, not only is Sarah barren, but they are both past the age of childbearing. There is no child. They are still without the promised seed. And the Lord comes to Abraham again, and Sarah can hear the conversation between the Lord and Abraham. And the Lord says the child will come through Sarah. And Sarah is in her tent and she laughs. And the Lord gives something of a gentle rebuke, but he says to both of them, is anything too hard for the Lord? Their faith had become weak. They were full of doubt. They didn't think it would happen, but is anything too hard for the Lord? And so it would seem that through that, faith was revitalized. And within the year, Sarah indeed gives birth to the promised seed. We made a few points in relation to this. Faith stands between death and life. The bodies of Abraham and Sarah are described as being dead in terms of childbearing. And yet out of them comes life. And so it is in terms of salvation. Standing between death and life is faith. The Lord regenerates, but in terms of us taking possession of life, so to speak, and experiencing life and becoming a believer. It's through faith we believe, and so we transition from death to life. And we also noted that Sarah's miraculous conception or her miraculous pregnancy, it mirrors another miraculous pregnancy, that of Mary. The situation between the two women obviously is very different. But there's a sense in which the promise with regards to the seed and the seed coming through women, it's bookended with miraculous conceptions. First of all, Sarah, who was barren, and then Mary. She wasn't barren, but her child, of course, comes from heaven. And so there are these miraculous pregnancies. So God does what is humanly possible. That's what we see here. He brings life out of death. That's true of salvation. And he sets in motion a covenant plan that is simply not humanly possible, that God will be joined to man, and through that union will come the salvation of the world. So that's what we were thinking about. There's a lot there, and we're really only scraping the surface. We turn our attention then to the next little passage, and that's verses 13 to 16. I think it may be helpful just to go back and to read from verse 8. So we'll read from verse 8 through to verse 16. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out of the place which he would receive, go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promises in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, Sarah herself also along with Abraham, by faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed. And she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky, in multitude innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. And in verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And so these verses here, 13 to 16, offer a kind of a summary statement as to those who had faith in the ancient world. They saw God's promises, yet they didn't enter into the fullness of them. They didn't receive them completely, yet they died with faith. Well, let's break these verses down, and we'll do so under three headings. So the first thing I want to note is that those with faith see the promises from a distance. So verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them from afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And so when the author to the Hebrews said, these all died in faith, we have to ask the question, well, who is he referring to? Who are the these? Which people does he mean? Is he referring to everybody who has been covered in this section so far? So we can go back to the faith of Abel, and we've seen Enoch, and we've seen Noah, more recently Abraham and Sarah, and also Isaac and Jacob have been mentioned. These people, does it refer to all of them? Or in closer sort of context, is he referring to verse 12 and the multitude that would eventually come from Abraham that cannot be numbered like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore? I think we can confidently say that these people is specifically referring to what we would call the patriarchs, who we would refer to as the patriarchs. That is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and we could include Sarah into the mix. And the reason why I believe this is the case is because of what comes next. I think that the context does determine who the author is referring to here. And so next, the author says, they died in faith, not having received the promises. And of course, this raises yet another question, and that's what Bible study is. Bible study is simply asking questions of the text. What does it mean? Who is it referring to? How do we understand it? And so what promises are in view here? And the context indicates that it's the promise of the land. And it's the promise of a great nation. That's what the author has been dealing with. If we go back to verses 8 and 10, the context, of course, is Abraham and the land. He was promised land and he set off on that journey. And, of course, we're told in relation to the land that he dwelt there, but he treated it as a temporary arrangement. He, along with his family, lived in tents. They didn't put down permanent dwellings, but rather they looked for a city with foundations, a permanent city whose builder and maker is God. But the land is in view in verses 8 to 10. And then in verses 11 and 12, it's the promise of a nation, a multitude of people that would come from Abraham, so vast in number it can't be numbered, like the stars in the sky or the sand on the seashore. A nation that would follow, come from him or follow on from his seed. And what we know, of course, is that the patriarchs, they entered the land. They dwelt in the land. But they never really took possession of it. They weren't part of the conquest that took place in the days of Joshua. So Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, they were in the land, but it never really became theirs in the true sense. That would come much later. And furthermore, obviously, Sarah conceived and she gave birth to a son, Isaac, and from Isaac came Jacob. And so the promise was filled partially in their presence, in the presence of the patriarchs, but none of them lived to see a nation. None of them lived to see millions and millions of people. It's estimated further down the track by the time Abraham's descendants do come to finally take possession of the promised land in the days of Joshua, it's estimated that they numbered somewhere in the region of 2 million people. They were a nation, and a nation is truly established through the giving of the law by Moses. It's like they're kind of ratified or formalized as a nation at that point. But the patriarchs never lived to see that. And they never lived to see all that would be involved in the Hebrew nation. The sacrificial system and the priesthood and the tabernacle, which would eventually become a temple, they didn't live to see any of that. So they saw the promises to a certain extent. They believed the promises. They took possession of the promises, but they never entered into them fully. They didn't take possession of the land. They never lived to see a great nation. God revealed things to them and they believed those things, but they didn't receive all the details. They didn't know, for example, exactly how the nations of the world would be blessed through this seed, through the nation that would come from Abraham. They didn't know all that involved. They couldn't envisage it. God didn't give them all the details. I quite like going to Cornell. And the landing spot of Captain Cook. Go there occasionally for a picnic on the grassed area. And when you stand where Cook actually landed, there's a great obelisk. And they have some plaques around the place, and the coordinates are actually given from Cook's diary. And you know exactly where he planted his feet. The outcrop of rock is there. It's described. The coordinates are given. That's exactly where Cook stood. And so they came ashore from the Endeavour. When you stand there and you look across Port Botany, you can see the Sydney skyline. He could not have envisaged what was coming. And I find it a kind of a profound thing. There's these great ships, there's planes coming into Sydney Airport, there's the skyline with the buildings. He had no idea what would be built and what the infrastructure would look like around and about. And likewise with the landing of the first fleet on the 26th of January, 18 years after Cook landed in Botany Bay, the first fleet came into Port Jackson, Sydney Harbour, and they anchored off what we refer to as Circular Quay, and they camped around the Circular Quay area. And again, I find it a deeply profound thing. They could not have envisaged what would be built around them and the infrastructure and the buildings and the people and the cities of this nation. They came to colonize. They came to use Australia as a giant prison. Not to build prison. The whole thing was the prison. They didn't know what would come from colonizing and all that would be involved. In a similar way, details were given to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and they believed what they were told, but they could not have envisaged all that was included. They didn't live to see the promises fulfilled. And at the end of their days, for each one of them, there was still a long way to go. And God never gave them a time frame. And Abraham knew full well that God's timing does not reckon with human timing. He thought after 11 years, God had probably washed his hands of him. And so he went into Hagar and decided to try and fulfill God's promise through his own wisdom and strength. After 25 years, the promise still had not been fulfilled. And so none of them lived to see the promise fulfilled. They knew, of course, that God's timing is not their timing. They all died with a kind of vision of the promise and a partial fulfillment, but not the fullness of it. And the author to the Hebrews says that they died in faith. Time did not erode their faith. They did not, in the big picture, though they had their ups and downs, and Abraham had his ups and downs, they hung on to the promise. They believed that God would fulfill what he had declared. They died in faith. They died as believers. It is a little reminder here that people will die either as believers or not as believers. People will die either with faith believing or they will die without faith and in unbelief. There are only two states in which human beings can die. It's one or the other. And there are people who make professions of faith and they're part of the Christian church and they grow tired of it all and they grow weary and disillusioned for different reasons and they throw the towel in, they wash their hands of the whole thing. And sadly, the faith they claim to have, they don't really have. They die as unbelievers. And so to have faith is to see things which are yet to materialize. Not all of the details, but the big picture, the details that are revealed. The author to the Hebrews says, having seen the promises afar off. In other words, they will be fulfilled in the distance. In time to come, having seen the promises from afar off, we're assured of them and embrace them. And the language here takes us back to Hebrews 11 and verse 1. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. It is the evidence of things not seen. For the patriarchs in this setting, what we are dealing with here, the promises that were seen in a visionary, futuristic way that they didn't enter into, it relates to land, it relates to a nation. But promises are given to you and I as well. The Bible is full of promises. And in the same way, we see them at a distance. We might say that they're really the promises we have are the true heart, the substance of the promises that were given under the Old Covenant. What promises are given to you and I that we see at a distance? Well, the promise of heaven. The promise that when we die, we will go to be with the Lord. The promise of a future judgment. The promise of the resurrection of the dead. The promise of a new heavens and a new earth. Now, we are given information with regards to these things, but we don't have all the details. We don't know exactly how all of this is to play out and what it's going to look like. We really don't. We have but a drop in the bucket, so to speak. What is heaven actually like? Well, read through Revelation, but the language is difficult to grasp. Because John is ultimately describing things which are beyond human comprehension. What will the judgment actually be? Can you visualize the entire world gathered before Jesus Christ and the separation into two camps. Can you visualize the raising of bodies from the ground, bodies that have been in the earth for thousands of years to the point there is nothing left of them? Can you visualize a new heavens and a new earth and what that will be like with Christ as the center? Well, we have the information. And by faith, we believe these things. We see them in a certain sense, but we're yet to enter into them. We don't know exactly what these things will be like. And if we are to see and to keep believing these promises, we must meditate upon them. We must own them. We must embrace them and take them to heart. And I touched on this last week. Faith feeds upon truth. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4. Peter says, God has given to us exceedingly great and precious promises. And we are saved because we believe the promises of God. But if we have faith in Jesus Christ, he will save us. We believe we will avoid God's judgment. We believe that we have an eternal inheritance awaiting for us. We believe the promises of God. And so we are saved, we believe the promises of God, and as we keep a focus upon the promises of God, so they keep us, as it were, on the straight and narrow path. The promises of God cultivate within us hope, so we don't become discouraged and dissatisfied with our lot in the world. The promises of God motivate us and help us and strengthen us to live as foreigners and sojourners in this world. And this, again, is what Peter reminds us of. He's already touched on it previously, but he says again in verse 13, having seen the promises afar off, were assured of them, embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. If we don't have faith in the promises of God, we will invariably live for what this world offers. We will see this world as our home. We won't look beyond the here and the now and the material things we own and that we give ourselves to. Of course, people live for the things of this world and they do give a measure of satisfaction. We're foolish if we think that everybody feels empty in the world and people in the world get nothing from the materialism and the relationships and then self-indulgence. People do get satisfaction from those things. But of course, most often, they go from one thing to the next. There is a degree of dissatisfaction, and so they go from one thing to the next. And even if people are content and happy with the world around them, they can't take it with them. 70, roughly speaking, our allotted time is 70 years thereabouts. And then we give up everything. We give up relationships. We give up what we've worked for, our money, our houses, our success and achievements. And so if we don't look to the promises of God and we don't have a big vision in terms of what is to come, a view to the future, we will live for the here. We'll live for something. It's just a question of what. Either we embrace the promises of God and live for what he presents to us, or we will live for this world. The second thing I want us to note, draw to your attention, those with faith seek a homeland. So firstly, those with faith see the promises at a distance, and secondly, those with faith seek a homeland. Verse 14. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. So those who believe in God's promises, they confess, they declare with their mouths, that they don't live for this world, that this world is not their home, that they are passing through, they are pilgrims and sojourners, but they confess and declare by their manner of life. What does a greedy person declare in terms of how they live? What does a covetous man or woman declare in terms of how they live? They declare the fact that they live for this world, that they're only interested in their money and success and houses. For those who believe the promises, they verbally and by way of life, the manner in which they live, they declare, they confess that they are passing through, they seek a different world beyond this world. Now our nation, if you want to use the word celebration, last Monday, January the 26th, commemorating the arrival of the First Fleet, our nation supposedly celebrated Australia Day. Of course, it's referred to Invasion Day and all of that kind of thing. But it is marked out on the calendar. It always has been all of my life. Australia Day has been a thing, and by all means, I have no issue with waving the flag and putting the flag up and all of that kind of stuff. It's not a problem whatsoever to me. But I would say, as Christians, while we celebrate the nation and the nation's achievements and our heritage and all of those things, I think from the Christian perspective, we ought to celebrate and give thanks to God for his goodness. This nation has prospered under the hand of God. And I would say this, at least for myself. I'm an Australian by birth. I love my home, and I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. As far as I'm an Australian, I am what you might call British Australian. I'm first generation Australian. All of my family going back, all of them are from the UK. My parents were 10-pound Poms. I've always taken great interest in my roots. I love my roots. But being an Australian and calling ourselves of this ethnicity or this nationality, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with waving the flag. There's nothing wrong with commemorating various things as a nation. But they are only earthly demarcations. You and I belong to a spiritual body, and if we refer to the language we've already seen in our sermons from 1 Peter and in chapter 2, and you remember how Peter describes believers, how he describes the church, a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. Holy nation is not Australia. It's not the UK or the US. A holy nation is the church. We belong to a spiritual body. I'm happy in a certain sense to have that banner above me consisting of a Union Jack and a Southern Cross, but it's only an earthly demarcation. The true banner under which I am to live and you are to live is the banner of the cross. Unless Christ returns first, I trust that I am on my way to a heavenly land. That is heaven. And if I go there, and I hope and I trust I will, I believe I will, then I will await the return of Christ up there, and he will come back to this world with all of his deceased saints. And those who are with him will come. And with Christ, the saints will judge the earth. We are told that. They will be part of the judgment process, and Christ will transform the world. It will be renewed. And this ultimately is the homeland that we look for. The heavenly Jerusalem coming to earth. That is the homeland that ultimately Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the patriarchs look toward. What is true for them is true for you and I. In 2 Peter chapter 3, it's a well-known passage in which Peter describes the renewal of the earth, and he talks about it in terms of a cleansing with fire. We spoke this morning of the earth being cleansed with water in the days of Noah. In the end, the renewal of the earth is described in 2 Peter chapter 3 as a cleansing by fire in which the earth will be renewed. All the filth and the dross and the muck that makes up this fallen universe will be consumed by the fire of God, and the earth will be renewed. But Peter describes it in these terms, the outcome of it. 2 Peter 3, 11 to 13. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved by the elements, making the universe what it is, therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his, nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. So Peter says this in relation to the renewal of the earth and the earth that we will inherit, looking for and hastening that day. And it's the same kind of language that is used in Hebrews 11 in relation to the patriarchs. Seeking this other world. They seek a homeland beyond that land, that earthly land promised by God. Seeking is to desire, it's to want something. They wanted God's promise, his provision, his blessing that goes beyond this earth. You think of the prayer in the Lord's Prayer, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And we can think about that in terms of a day-by-day blessing that we are looking for God to bring. Your will be done today, your will be done tomorrow. But in the bigger picture, that prayer is for heaven to come to earth, for the earth to be transformed. And we seek it in our prayers. We long for God to bring justice and renewal and holiness to the earth. This world in terms of its renewal is what we seek and what we long for. And Peter uses this language. The author to the Hebrews talks of seeking. It's to desire. It's to want something. But Peter, looking at the same issue, he speaks of looking for and hastening, and the idea of looking is to anticipate, it's to hope. It's like a wife and her husband's been away. Let's say he's gone off to war or he's gone off on a long journey, and every day she peers through the curtain, she looks outside, longing for the return of her husband. She's looking for him, She's anticipating it. That's the language that is used of believers in relation to this new earth, this new homeland, this renewal that is coming to the ground that is under our feet, looking for, longing, anticipating. Peter says hastening, and the idea is to urge on. It could convey the idea of working towards something. How do we work toward the renewal of the earth? Well, we do so by being the people that God would have us to be, by living godly lives, by pursuing the things of God, by spreading forth the word that more might come into his kingdom. 2 Peter 3:11, therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Godliness and service to God and worship and good works and all of these things are undertaken with a view for what is to come. We are preparing ourselves for what God has in store. We are to live in this world in such a way that we anticipate the world that is to come. And then thirdly, those with faith don't turn back. Verse 15. It's So again, the patriarchs are in mind here. Verse 15, and truly, if they had called to mind that country which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. And so this is referring to the Ur of the Chaldeans, to Ur of the Chaldeans. Remember in Genesis chapter 11, verse 31, and Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, his son Abram's wife, and they went out from the Ur of the Chaldeans to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to Haran and dwelt there. And so Abram and his family and all that belonged to them made a journey from Ur of the Chaldeans to take possession of the land promised by God. And they made their way there and they dwelt there, but it never entered their mind that they would ever return from where they came. And we know that things didn't always go as Abraham had expected in Canaan. We've seen that in relation to Hagar and Ishmael. But it's not only that. Things didn't go well for them in the land. They went there and they encountered drought. And Abraham made some foolish decisions, and one of the most foolish that he made was when the drought came, he headed down to Egypt. That's never what God intended for them, to leave the promised land to go to Egypt. It was a foolish decision. And though he never intended to stay there and he did return, it was a bad choice. And even with the bad choices that he made and things not going as he had hoped, he didn't get the child that he hoped for according to God's plan. Things didn't always go well in the land, but in spite of his foolish decisions and the mistakes that he made, it never entered his mind to go back to Ur of the Chaldeans. He never said to Sarah, look, it's not playing out. This promised land is more a land of curse than a land of promise. We should return to what we know, to what is familiar to our extended family and our friends. Let's go back from where we came. And my parents were 10-pound Poms. They came here in the mid-1960s. My mother landed in Australia, saw Adelaide and burst into tears. Didn't really want to live there. It's my father's idea. If you've ever been to Adelaide, you can understand why you got burst into tears. The northern suburbs of Adelaide is a veritable arid desert, quite frankly. And many of the Poms, the 10-pound Poms, they went back. It's not what they expected. Australia was not the land of promise that it seemed to be when it was presented to them in the UK. It's not what they envisaged. My parents stuck it out. For Abraham and patriarchs, they put it out of their mind, any notion of going back. We can't help but contrast, of course, Abraham's future descendants with him at this point. Of course, they grew to be a mighty nation and they were eventually enslaved in Egypt for hundreds of years and they were crying out to God because of their treatment and the harshness and the barbarity of slavery, and God heard their prayers and he delivered them. And in that deliverance and being sent again to the land of promise, God showed them miracle after miracle after miracle. Life wasn't easy for them on the road, and with the difficulty of having children and burying the dead and collecting food and all of these things, many of them longed to go back. Egypt wasn't so bad after all, and they spoke about the fruit and the vegetables and all of those things, and you know the difficulties of the journey, and they complained to God and they wanted to go back. And of course, as a consequence, they perished. They didn't have faith. You know, it's really quite amazing how easily people delude themselves with the idea that their former life was better, that their life was better off without the Lord. You know, they're in the church, they're participating in church life, they're serving God, yet things don't work out as they envisage. There are difficulties, there are challenges. And they begin to long for the former days. They begin to long for the life of unbelief when they weren't Christians. And that looks a whole lot easier than serving the Lord and walking with Him. The man who led me to the Lord, to the best of my knowledge, he's no longer a practicing Christian. I lost touch with him after I became a Christian, and I'd been in church life for many years, and Kylie and I ran into him in a shopping centre. Hadn't seen him for a long time. And he said to me, he no longer believed. He no longer attended church. And he said of his wife, she hated church that much. She wished the earth would open up and swallow churches whole, because they'd had difficulties in a series of churches. They had had troubles and problems with people, and things hadn't worked out, and they just washed their hands of the faith. And then I heard sometime after that they were divorced. The Hebrews, in their sinful ignorance, longed to return to Egypt, but Abraham and his family, though they failed at points, though they experienced difficulties on a number of levels, they never entertained any thought of going back to Ur. They never treated Canaan as their forever home. You know, they use that language, don't they, on these renovation shows and buying house shows on TV, the forever house. But Abraham and the patriarchs never looked at Canaan in those terms of, you know, our forever place, our forever home. They lived in tents. They never put down permanent dwellings. They knew there was more to come. They knew that Canaan was a token of what was to come, and they had this bigger vision for a world beyond this world. They knew that there were better things, a better land, an eternal dwelling. We read in verse 16, but now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So they were a God-focused people. They had their ups and downs. Their faith was not perfect. But they kept before them the promises. They knew that the land and the nation and all of these physical things pointed to something else, something of eternal significance, and they kept that in view. Well, to close this evening, the promises of God are set before us in His Word, and we must keep them in view. And especially when life is tough, we should always have them in view, but especially when we are experiencing difficulties. And our mindset ought to be very much the mindset of Peter in the passage that was read to us before. And as Basil pointed out, that reading comes on the back of the feeding of the 5,000, and Jesus used that as an illustration that people must eat his flesh and drink his blood. And he means, of course, to believe upon him and to understand the significance of what he would do, not literally his flesh and blood. But as he spoke in that language, we are told that people struggled with it. They didn't get it. These things are hard to understand. Hard sayings. What is he talking about? Cannibalism. This is too much. And we are told that when he began to speak in those terms, many ceased to follow him. They washed their hands of him. We've had enough of this. We don't know what he means. He's speaking in riddles. What's he talking about? And many ceased to follow him. And the Lord Jesus says to his apostles, are you too going to go away? Are you going to leave me as they have? Do you find it too hard? Are you going to go away as well? And Peter's words, they really, in a sense, I mean, obviously all scripture is important, but Peter's words are kind of immortalized, at least they are in my mind. What Peter says in response, Jesus asks him, do you want to go away? Do you want to leave me as well? And Peter says, Lord, to whom do we go? you have the words of eternal life. What are the options? We don't understand everything you say. It's not easy to be a follower. It does bring with it its own challenges and difficulties, and you promised us that. But if we wash our hands of you and what you have taught us, to what do we turn? Who else is, what else is there? If we depart from the Lord because life is painful, what do we gain instead? All we have is this world and it's passing away. We are passing away. Whatever we gain, we can't take it with us. As we continue to walk with the Lord, we must keep before us the promises that are set out in his word. And should we die before he returns, and I dare say we will, I don't know when he's coming back, but I would imagine if not all, at least some of us will die, probably all of us will die, who knows. But if we die before Christ returns, what was said of the patriarchs in our passage can also be said of us. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. When Christians die, it means that they have not received all the promises of God. They have not understood all that the promises involve. They get the big picture and the main ideas, but they don't know all the details. Don't understand all that is involved in the resurrection of the body and the judgment of humanity and the vindication of the righteous and the rewards that are coming to the righteous, and all of these things are a glorious new heavens and new. They don't know all that is involved in these things, but we keep them before our eyes, we believe them, and we declare with our mouths and in terms of how we live that this world is not our home. We live for better things to come, these promises that are set before us. God has given to us many, many exceedingly great and precious promises. And if we keep them before our eyes, if we meditate upon them, if we embrace them, then we will maintain a right perspective of life. We will maintain right priorities. We will have a right outlook in life. We will know how to process the good and we will know how to process the bad. And in it all, we will say this world is not our home, but rather we seek a kingdom. We seek a city that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God, a city beyond this world, meaning the transformation of the world as it presently is. We will live as pilgrims and sojourners on our way to better things. Well, may the Lord bless his word to us. May he help us to embrace the example that we see in Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob as they looked to the promises of God. May he bless these thoughts to us. Amen.